This is Colourful.
New survey out today says that only 1 in 7 of us ends up in the career we dreamt of as a child. That's probably just as well, otherwise we'd have a nation full of train drivers, footballers and pop stars.
Firemen.
And firefighters and maybe the occasional astronaut. Pleased to say that our next guest has fulfilled his dream, I suspect, because Courtney Griffiths QC, that's what you dreamt of as a child, isn't it? Being a lawyer.
From about the age of 11, it's always been my ambition to be a jury advocate. And thankfully, you know, I've managed to achieve that goal.
I'm just looking at some of the trials in which you've played a leading role, and there are many, including, of course, the Damilola Taylor murder trial, and poor Damilola lost his life 10 years ago this weekend. We have another number of big trials, the Keith Blakelock murder trial, the Brighton bombing, the Harrods bombing, the Canary Wharf bombing. People are very aware of what you're doing at the moment, of course, in The Hague, defending Charles Taylor, former president of Liberia, and people will have seen you on the continuous news channels a few months ago on Sky News and BBC News Channel as well. Would you say that that was not your finest hour, but the hour when people then started to say, my word, that's who he really is, Courtney Griffiths?
In a sense, you know, Henry, it was a bit of a disappointment that all of a sudden at that particular point, because a supermodel turned up, the whole world's media was focused on the trial when we'd been running since January 2008.
Yes.
And nobody was interested. And, you know, it's sad that having practiced for some 30 years, my career is now going to be defined by the appearance of a supermodel in a criminal trial in a distant court in The Hague.
I'm sure you don't really feel that, though, do you? I mean, you must know that, of course, the people in the know will judge you by a different measure. But I suppose, in terms of people day-to-day, walking down the street, is that what they say to you? Oh, you're the guy who's attacking Naomi Campbell or defending Charles Taylor. Is that what people are saying to you?
Exactly. And, you know, I had a bit of that with the Damilola Taylor trial,
yes,
with people coming up to me and, you know, being quite abusive, even though it later transpired that that first trial was a travesty, because...
Yeah.
All of those young men were acquitted, and it was later discovered that three completely different boys may have been those responsible. So, you know, I've had that experience before.
Does it mean that you've had to grow a very, very thick skin? Because I saw you just a few days ago at the unveiling of a plaque to Rudy Narayan, a man who became very, very celebrated, on screen indeed as well, in the 80s, through a drama called Black Silk. And I understand you knew him very well. And he died some 12 years ago. People wanted to kind of celebrate his memory. And then during the evening, a young man confronted you and said, well, hang on a minute, you defend murderers. And I was wondering how you were feeling at that particular point.
Well, it's an accusation which has been made against me continuously. How can you defend these despicable characters? It's never really posed a moral dilemma for me, because at the end of the day, I'm not the one making the decision as to guilt or innocence. I am there merely to present a case. I am the voice of the defendant in the courtroom. So what is being said are the defendant's ideas about the truth or otherwise of his case. So I've never really had a problem with that. And so it's not really a question of developing a thick skin. It's a question of recognizing and defining your role within the criminal justice system.
My understanding has always been that as a lawyer, you couldn't defend somebody if you knew them to be guilty. Is that correct?
Not quite correct. Now, my starting point is this. The very last question you ask a criminal defendant is, did you do it? Because if you ask that question and get the wrong answer, that is, yes, I did do it.
Yes.
It does compromise your ability to defend that person in this way. Take, for example, a bank robbery, and the sole evidence against the defendant is identification. That is, someone has a fleeting glance of someone leaving the bank and getting into the getaway car. If that defendant says to me, Mr. Griffiths, yes, I did it, what I can't do is suggest to the eyewitness, this wasn't the man you saw. What I can say to the eyewitness, though, is this the man you saw? Because then I'm not putting a positive case. So in effect, I'm not misleading the court, because the very last thing I can do as a defense advocate is to mislead either the judge or the jury as to the guilt or innocence of my client. And I hope people appreciate the difference.
So if you frame the questions in a certain way, you can know that the defendant is guilty.
Yes, I can. I can.
And that's allowable, is it?
That is allowable, because I am not there to walk into court and say to the judge, my client is guilty.
Have you got off people who you knew were guilty?
Of course he has.
No,
I'm just saying, because it's obvious.
No, I know. I want to know the answer.
Gone. Can we allow Courtney to answer,
I think the answer is quite simple. I've only ever defended innocent people, because everybody is innocent until proven guilty. So if somebody, as you put it, gets off, that's because the jury found them not guilty.
Okay.
But what if I, let's take a hypothetical thing now. Let's say that I came to you tomorrow and I said, I've murdered Cheryl Cole. Just say that, you know, this is hypothetical. I've drowned her in her own L'Oreal shampoo. And I did it, Courtney, but I want you to get me off. How are we going to do this? What happens then? There must be people that in the moment of, you know, just in the aftermath, they're so scared. They're filled with fear and dread and thinking that they're going to lose their whole life. They're going to be behind bars for 25 years. And they, some people must break down and tell you, I did it, but I don't want to go to prison. What do you say then?
Well, some people might say that killing Cheryl Cole would be a good thing.
You understand?
But we couldn't possibly comment, of course.
Well, I don't expect you to. But in any event, if you did come to me, if... Personally, I have never had a client confess to me in that dramatic way.
Really?
Never. Never. In 30 years of defending, it has never happened. Of course, as a lawyer with that experience, you can read between the lines and think, perhaps my client isn't telling me the full story.
Mm.
But remember, at the end of the day, as a barrister, I am presented with the material by a solicitor. So the solicitor may well have that dramatic confession,
mm-hmm.
but by the time the papers come to me, it has, in a sense, been sanitized. And my job then is to present the material I've been given in the courtroom. That's my job.
Can I ask you about a TV series last year? I think it was called Criminal Justice, which ran and which purported to dramatise the circumstances of what it was like if somebody was accused of a crime. And in it, it seemed to imply that virtually the defendants were being introduced to their clients, if I remember correctly, virtually the night before in some cases. Is that true?
In many cases, it is true, because you understand that the first port of call for a defendant is his solicitor, who will more than likely have seen him in the police cell, being present when he was interviewed, has then put together the case papers and presented it to a barrister to present in court. That's not always strictly true nowadays, because many solicitors now have rights of audience in the higher courts. But many times you will find that a barrister has been instructed and the case he's involved in is overrun. And so the solicitor at the last minute has to find a replacement. So you are right in many cases. And it tends to be the more minor cases, but sometimes also the most important cases, that somebody will see their barrister for the first time on the morning that their trial is due to start. Not satisfactory.
Satisfactory. It's completely unsatisfactory. Can you go into court and say, I need an adjournment, I've only met the client 10 minutes ago?
Well, you can do, but oftentimes judges will be unsympathetic.
But why would they be when it's clearly kind of unjust?
Well, they're unsympathetic because, sadly, our criminal justice system nowadays is ruled by economics. It's the costs. And wasting court time is anathema to most judges. And so consequently, some judges will force you to go ahead, even though you haven't had adequate time to acquaint yourself, not only with the papers, but also with your client.
Okay, we're speaking to Courtney Griffiths, QC, number 7 in the Power List, 2011. If you've got any questions you want to ask him, please do. Colourfulradio.com and click on email me or text us on 80818. Start your text with the word colourful, leave a space, and then your message. Now, we had a little bit of a chat last night at the Power List event, didn't we, Courtney? And I want to take it right back to the beginning, because you're actually not a Londoner, really, even though you come in here talking about South London.
You are... coming here.
You're from Coventry, aren't you? You landed in Coventry when you were 5 years old.
Yes, I landed in Coventry when I was five, almost six, in the autumn of 1961. Having spent 3 weeks travelling from Kingston, Jamaica, we travelled by boat from Kingston to Genoa in Italy, and then they put us all on a sealed train so we couldn't get off from Genoa to Calais, and then we got a boat train from Calais to Dover, a ferry from Calais to Dover, and then the boat train from Dover to Charing Cross Station, where I saw my father to recognize him for the first time, because he'd left Jamaica when I was 10 weeks old to come to the UK to find work. Because as everybody knows, during that time in the 1950s, many people from the Caribbean had to leave to come to the United Kingdom to find work. And it wasn't the first time that my father had made such a journey, because he'd worked on widening the Panama Canal during the Second World War. He'd also done farm work in the United States. And so when he came here, being a carpenter, he went to Coventry because, as everybody knows, Coventry was devastated during the war, and so there were many opportunities in the construction trade there. So that's where I landed, and that's where I grew up. And, you know, I come from a family of eight boys and one girl. I'm the second youngest. And when we arrived, winter was about to start, and we didn't have any winter clothing. So you can imagine my mother and father leading this line of nine black kids through a Coventry not yet used to a black presence. And, you know, white people would come up to my parents and say, can we touch them? Because, you know, here in First World Britain, they had this superstition that touching a black child would bring them luck. Can you imagine?
Really?
I've never actually heard that before.
Nor have I.
I mean, people used to want to touch me in the 70s, but nobody ever said, bring me good luck, Bonsu.
This is Colourful.
We're going to come out of this track a little earlier because we want to get back to Courtney Griffiths QC, number 7 in the power list, as I keep saying, who's in the studio with us this morning, I'm very glad to say, and it's all interesting stuff. Just got to say, just off air there, Courtney was telling us about his vinyl collection, his reggae vinyl collection, and giving us a bit of history on the Chiang Kai-shek track that we play behind our interviews on The Breakfast Show. He was saying that back in the day, it was a big tune.
Yes, it was a big tune. Big tune. You could get a blues party rocking anytime you put that on, because everybody would be on their feet dancing. Because I used to DJ on a sound system called Jabadis in Coventry.
Jabadis.
Jabadis. And we had a Jabadis football team as well. And, you know, back in the day then, you know, I had my dreadlocks because that was the thing back in the 70s. And I only got rid of them after I left the London School of Economics.
I mean, really funny, a dreadlock QC. Do we have any dreadlock QC? I know we have a dreadlock peer, Lord Victor Adebowale, who was there at the launch of this year's Powerless last night. But do we have any dreadlock QCs at the moment?
I can think of two dreadlock barristers.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Although one of them has trimmed his locks since, which is a shame.
Well, okay, maybe he's thinking about career progression. Anyway, 9:34 is the time. Good morning, Courtney, Juju, Henry and Tobias. He's calling you Tobias, Toby. This is from Dr. Bology. We call him our Tea Party Nigerian. And he says, Courtney, why criminal law, not commercial law? It, you know, pays far better. Companies have deep pockets.
Well, that is true. And particularly in these straitened times when legal aid is being cut, most criminal barristers have to be looking to develop another string to their bow.
Yep.
But I decided on criminal law because of the particular social circumstances in which I grew up.
Yeah.
Remember, I was growing up in a Britain not yet used to the presence of young black people. This was the time of the Suss Law. And I recall that back in the day, you know, police would routinely raid our house in Coventry whenever an event took place which involved black boys because...
Or Jabadas.
Because you know, we were a large family of boys, and so we would be the first port of call. They would knock on the door, push my father out of the way, storm upstairs and take out whichever of my brothers they wanted.
Mm.
And it was that experience of direct racism by the police which made me feel that I wanted to take the struggle of black people out on the street into the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people like Rudy Nye Ryan, who you mentioned, were already blazing that particular trail. But I was coming from a different viewpoint because I had directly experienced it myself on the streets.
Courtney, just picking you up on that point, and this burning need to see justice done, and going back to the point I was making about justice as it is done now, we've been seeing student riots yesterday about student fees, you know, rising. Nobody seems to be making any kind of fuss about the changes to legal aid, which was pretty dire in the first place. And what I'm wondering is, why aren't the legal profession making more of a fuss about this? Because it seems to me that justice is going out the window here because it's so hard to get represented in a court of law.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. But the difficulty is, most members of the public have very little sympathy for lawyers, because their impression is that all lawyers are making big money, which is why the legal profession is such an attractive profession for many. But the reality is, the vast majority of lawyers who are defending in the criminal courts, who are providing legal experience in the family courts, are being paid on legal aid, and they're not making large sums of money. You've got barristers going to court, travelling to, say, Sheffield, to spend the day in court to earn £50. And after they've paid their travelling expenses, they're operating at a loss.
So is there an alternative? Can you see a way out of that?
Well, it's very difficult to see a way out of that until the public come to realise that their rights are going to be compromised if there isn't a properly funded criminal justice system, and also that legal aid provision is made available so that homeless people, so that families who are having their children taken away by social services, so that immigrants who are seeking to appeal them being sent out of the country do have proper representation so they can put forward their case.
So if that's the case, right, why aren't you, as a prominent lawyer, out there making this case now? You've got all the publicity. Why aren't you using it?
Well, we are making that case. But it's difficult to make that case for me individually from The Hague. But the Bar Council, which governs my profession, and in particular the Criminal Bar Association and the Family Bar Association, have been making this case consistently, not only to this government, but to the previous government. But as I say, the public are not sympathetic towards us because they don't appreciate the dire straits in which many lawyers operate.
Let's take you back to those evenings in Coventry when you had police jumping out of the Black Maria, storming into your house, pushing your father aside and taking one of your brothers away. How did that make you feel? And then how did you move from that feeling of anger to take it constructively to the next stage?
Well, I think, Henry, I need to start from a different point in order to get here. Because when I was 11 years old, I passed my 11 plus and went to a private grammar school in Coventry. Mm-hmm. It's now a private school. And one of the things that I learned there, because as the only black kid in that school from age 11 until 18 and a half when I left.
So what, in 7 years, no other black children came through?
Yeah, from I was 11 years until I was 18 and a half years old, I was the only black child of African or Afro-Caribbean origin in that school.
Wow.
There were two other Asian boys at the time. Remember, we're talking about the 60s, going into the 70s. And one of the things I learned from that experience, which I've carried with me ever since, in that kind of school, as compared to, say, a comprehensive school, you're taught that you're going to be the leaders of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And in that context, a teacher can't put me in one corner and say to the other children, you're going to be the leaders, but not him.
Right.
And as a result, I developed a certain confidence from that, a certain belief in my own ability.
Yes.
Which meant that when that experience of police bursting into the house, in many ways strengthened my confidence, because it made me realize that I have an ability to try and right some of these wrongs in the courtroom.
So you thought, well, just keep bringing it on, I'll have my day in court.
Precisely. And not only that, one of the most powerful things I learned from that experience, and it was reinforced when I went to work at the Ken Livingstone Greater London Council in the early 1980s, was this, that at the end of the day, racism isn't really my problem. Mm-hmm. Of course we have a duty and a responsibility to try and rid our society of racism. But I learned from school and the GLC that racism is often used to distract you from your real ambition. And so you spend so much time worrying about what the racists think about you that you don't do what you're put in that position to do. So we had a situation at the GLC where this institution, which hadn't seen black people like myself coming in and holding positions of responsibility, turned against us. And then as a result, many of the blacks who had been propelled into the GLC because of the riots of the early 1980s, mm-hmm. when Labour here in London realised that they needed to co-opt some of us in order to give themselves a degree of credibility. Remember, that's the time when people like Paul Boateng and now Lord Ouseley were drawn into the GLC, into positions of power. And our experience then was that the white workers who had been at the GLC for years turned against us. And many of us in retaliation, you know, started thinking about racial awareness training. Let's teach them about rice and peas and
Sarahs and samosas.
Yeah, in order for them to understand us. And as a result, they didn't do what the black communities in Brixton and elsewhere put them in there to do, which was to do a job, show their excellence, and change things. Instead, they got distracted and spent all of their time fighting this internal racism within the GLC. And so, you know, I think we need to realize at the beginning of the 21st century, yes, it's a problem, but don't allow it to distract you from achieving your goals.
See, I'm really interested in this because I mean, I was going to mention this to Ken.
Ken Olisa this morning. That's right, yes.
I got a sense when he was talking and did his speech that there was very much a kind of thread through everything he said that basically said, race is so yesterday, you know, it's old news. And I wonder what you think about that. You sound like you're on the same tip slightly.
Well, racism isn't old news in the sense that we can afford to ignore it. My view on it is this. As I say, don't allow it to distract you. At the end of the day, believe in your ability and your willingness to achieve your own goals. But let the racist beware. There is a line beyond which, if he crosses, I will headbutt him. Right? That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I am not going to allow racism to occupy my mind and, in effect, you know, occupy parts of my mind which I can be devoting to more creative things. That's not going to happen.
But hasn't one needed both the people who will say, like you, like Ken Olisa, like many of the people in the power list, I'm going to be excellent, and through my excellence they will see just how quality we are as a people, and those like the Lord Ouseleys, like the Linda Bellosses, like the Paul Boatengs and others who will do it politically through activism and indeed, yes, sometimes through the race relations awareness training. Don't you need both prongs? We can't dismiss the other.
No, I'm not dismissing the other, which is why I say there is a line over which you should not cross. Yeah. And, you know, we need to appreciate that the idea of institutional racism is still very much there.
Yeah.
For many of us, there is still this glass ceiling. So, yes, that struggle has to go on. But I'm saying in terms of projecting yourself as an individual, in terms of you as an individual saying, I have the ability to do this and no one is going to be distract me from that goal. I think, you know, to agree with Ken, to an extent at that level,
yes,
racism is very much old history.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the voice of Courtney Griffiths. Powerful stuff on Colourful Radio this morning. Please do get in touch, colourfulradio.com, and click on email me if there's any questions you want to put to Courtney. He's going to be with us for another 15 minutes or so. You mentioned breaking through glass ceilings. One of my good friends is a guy called Tony Roberts. He's actually the son of John Roberts QC, who's probably somebody you know of. And also, you know, the Baroness Scotlands of this world, etc. We all know about those people. And we spoke to Matthew Ryder QC around the time that you were blowing up on our screens everywhere and everybody was talking about Courtney. And he was talking a little bit about you and the fact that you are probably one of the first QCs who really has come and made no compromises. You're your own person with your own voice and your own style. You put your own flavour on things when you're in the courtroom. You're not trying to kind of act like you're supposed to act as a barrister and be very grounded in it. You speak in your own tongue. And I'm wondering who your role models were in the sense that you're very different from the kind of people that did break through those glass ceilings before you.
Juju, I'm glad you mentioned speaking with one's own tongue. Because one of the big problems I had, particularly when I started in the profession, was that so many black barristers at the bar felt that they needed to project a certain image and speak in a very kind of posh way in order to make their way in the profession. I've never, ever accepted that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I actually think, because advocacy is a performing art, you have to be at ease within your own skin in order to project your personality as an advocate. And for that reason, I've never lost my voice. I've spoken patois in court, you know them weirdo. Because at the end of the day, that's my origin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where I am coming from. And that's what gives me the particular ability to articulate certain viewpoints in the courtroom. And I always think one needs to be true to oneself. In whatever walk of life one operates, you need to be true to your personality and to your background. Because as I said at the Rudy Narayan unveiling of the blue plaque, you know, yesterday is connected to today and today is connected to tomorrow. So one should always remember where one is coming from in order to know where you are going. But in terms of my legal heroes, first and foremost was Norman Washington Manley, the first Prime Minister of Jamaica. Remember, he was made a QC here in the UK back in the 1930s. In fact, during the Second World War, he defended a black airman who was charged with murder at Manchester Assizes, as it then was. And the first police officer he cross-examined refused to refer to him as Sir. Wow. Until the High Court judge told him that he had to. And at the end of the trial, when his client was gloriously acquitted, the High Court judge, I think it was Mr. Justice Sellers, remarked to the defendant, if genius is a question of taking pains in preparation, you've been represented by a genius. That was Norman Washington Manley.
Wow.
One of the greatest advocates to have come out, well, in any common law jurisdiction around the world. And then secondly, of course, there was Rudy Narayan. Narayan, for my part, is one of the best jury advocates this country has ever seen. In the courtroom, in terms of a cross-examiner, in terms of his ability to articulate in a closing speech to a jury, he had very few peers. And I say that without fear of contradiction.
Yeah.
Rudy Narayan as a courtroom advocate was a genius, and he's not appreciated well enough to my mind.
We have to big up Nubian Jack then for doing what he's done with the blue plaque.
Got a text here from Iyamide before Toby comes in with another question. We've got so much to talk about, we've only got another 11 minutes. Iyamide asks you, Courtney, whether Kevin Metzger is one of the dreadlock barristers you know. Otherwise, he says, there are three, or she says. Also, any doubts about accepting to be on the Charles Taylor defence team? Well, you're leading it. Some Sierra Leonean lawyers did have misgivings. And also, Iyamide says, I was also at the GLC around that time. And you were.
Well,
questions there.
Well, first of all, Kevin, now you bring it to mind, yes, he has developed dreadlocks of late.
Developed.
Of late. We have had Sierra Leonean lawyers on our team. And in fact, I've quite deliberately sought to recruit Sierra Leoneans to work with the team because I think it's important for them to realize that even though Charles Taylor has been demonized as the person who wrecked their country and controlled all these atrocities, they need to see that in every criminal trial, in order for the criminal process to be credible, there has to be a credible prosecution and there has to be a credible defense. And many of them have learned a lot from that experience. So I'm glad that I've been in a position to do that. And I don't know what your caller's experience was at the GLC. I'd like to know what that was.
Yamide, please text again.
Just going on to the trial in The Hague and the International Criminal Court generally, do you feel it's a kind of racist institution in itself in that the only people ever up there seem to me either they're renegades from former Yugoslavia or they're from Africa? And that we've got Charles Taylor. Now, last week, I think we had the guy from the Congo, the
Jean-Pierre Bemba.
And because for the simple, I sort of get the impression that what we've got here is a highly ambitious guy, the Spanish guy, whoever it is who runs it, determined to
Ocampo,
put.
Ocampo, is it?
He's Argentinian.
Is he Argentinian? Yeah. I'm sorry. Determined to put his name in the frame, as it were. And meanwhile, but what you don't see is the other potential. Recipients of justice, if you like, the Tony Blairs, the George Bushes. Not that I'm suggesting they should be there, because I've got a I've got a profound problem with the whole idea of it. because I think in the end, you should be tried by your peers, and I've got a real problem with the International Criminal Court generally.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, and I'd like to answer it at three levels. Level number one is this. One has to appreciate that societies like the DRC, like Liberia, like Sierra Leone, have existed in a state of stasis for many, many years. Remember, in the DRC, you had Mobutu. Then we had Tubman in Liberia. And we had various military regimes and Shaka Stevens in Sierra Leone. And the point I'm making is this. With the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, many of these societies were going through seismic social changes. And in every society where such seismic changes have occurred, there has always been bloodshed. The English Civil War, the French Revolution, the American Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, the Russian Revolution. Yet, those revolutions were never stigmatized by being described as criminals. Yet, these social revolutions which are taking place in Africa now are being criminalized through this idea that they're committing atrocities and so on. Those same atrocities were committed in all those previous revolutions in every other society. So why is it different now? Point number two is this. Yes, you are right. Currently, there are five people awaiting trial in the ICC. And most of the investigations currently being conducted by the ICC are where? Africa. Now, it is right that many of the wars currently taking place are on the African continent. But it's funny that when the Bokassas of this world, when the Mobutus of this world, when the Vorsters of this world, when the Verwoods of this world were committing atrocities against Africans, the West were completely silent. Why? Because those leaders were in the Western camp. And it suited the superpower, the Americans at that stage, to maintain those dictators in position. And yet now, all of a sudden, for different reasons, and I say there are political and economic reasons, certain Africa is being targeted again. Let me give you one example. Darfur is being totally misrepresented by the Western media. Everybody thinks that what is going on there is the killing of Africans by the northern Arab population of the Sudan. What is not often being said by the George Clooneys of this world is that one of the reasons why they want Darfur to break away is because Darfur is sitting on an ocean of oil. And that's what the West wants. And they're frightened because the Chinese are in there already. So the international criminal law is now being used as a neo-colonialist tool in order to ensure that the West continue to obtain various important minerals. So it's not by chance that we have this in Sudan, in the DRC. The DRC has perhaps the greatest mineral resources of any country on the planet. And the vast majority of the ICC investigations are, guess where? There.
This is Colourful.